Today, I'm speaking with Dr. Anna Wilson. Anna has a PhD in nuclear physics and worked as a physicist in the US, the UK, and Australia. She worked at the Australian National University for over 12 years, and there she won two awards for teaching and co-led a national project on undergraduates' experiences of research. She completed her second PhD in education at the University of Stirling in 2016, and currently she is a lecturer there. Thank you very much for joining me. I'm really interested in hearing about how your career has evolved from physics into education. And do you remember how you became interested in physics? And looking back on that time, do you think there were signs that education was also going to be important to you?
It's a really hard question, that remembering how or when I first got interested in physics, because I was just interested in the world and in all sorts of different things, and also interested in thinking from quite an early age. And to me, that's part of what physics is. It's a way of thinking and a way of thinking about the world. I'd already by the age of 13 settled on physics as being the thing I was interested in scientifically, but I can't really say where that came from.
Do you remember why you wanted to get a PhD in physics? Was there a certain topic you wanted to study?
Oh, no. I reached the end of my degree, which was in physics and philosophy, and I was pretty sure I wasn't going to get a first. And back then, you wouldn't get funding to do a PhD in philosophy without a first, and I didn't want a job. So the only other alternative was to do a PhD in physics. That's completely honest answer. It wasn't that I didn't want to work. I was quite happy to work, but this was 1993, and the companies that were recruiting physics graduates were things like British Aerospace. I had absolutely no intention of working in defence or any defence-related thing, or Shell or Esso.
Physics courses in schools and universities tend to have many more boys and men than girls and women. Did you ever find that awkward or challenging?
No. No, I guess I didn't even really notice it. I was at a girls' school from the age of 10. In fact, there were only two of us that did physics A-level in my year because so few female students do physics. And then, of course, when I got to university, yes, there were about 120 people in my year doing physics, and I think there were only about 20 female students in that group. But I can't say I really noticed. I mean, I was aware of it as a statistic, but I didn't feel like, oh my God, this is a totally male-dominated environment. I wasn't that hung up on what gender people were. And in some ways, almost the opposite is true. That so obviously almost everywhere I've ever worked has been predominantly male. There is a lab just outside Paris, nuclear physics lab, at a place called Orsay. For quite a period of time, that had more female scientists in it than males. And I used to go there a lot. I worked very closely with some of the researchers there while I was doing my PhD and then later. That was weird. It felt really weird to be in a group that was dominantly female. And now that I'm in the social sciences faculty, yeah, it's predominantly women as well. And I've got used to it, but I guess just for such a long part of my life, I was used to being surrounded more by men than women. I don't tend to notice it very much. I guess the thing I will say was that things like Isabel, one of the researchers there, would sing in her office. Just things like that, that there would be female singing voices, and it just, and the sound of, the really noticeable thing, I think, was the sound of high heels clicking down the corridors, which just didn't sound right. You don't hear that in a lab normally, but yeah, you'd hear it all day, every day, there would be high heels clicking up and down the corridor.
So you worked at the Australian National University for over 12 years, and you won awards for teaching. Why did you decide to leave?
Why did I decide to leave? Oh. Again, honest answer, because I got to about 40. I reached a point where I thought, I've got 25 years of working life ahead of me. I can't imagine doing the same thing for another 25 years. I would just get incredibly bored. I decided I wanted to change, and the natural thing at that point seemed, given that I was already doing some education research, the natural point seemed to be to kind of move more in that direction. Two factors with that. One, ANU doesn't have a School of Education or a Faculty of Education. And although my colleagues in physics were incredibly lovely and kept saying, oh, you should stay and you can be doing physics education research, I didn't really want to do physics education research. I think physics education research is rather limited. But it just wasn't what I wanted to do. And it didn't feel right either to be in, you know, in this, okay, it's not the REF in Australia, it's a thing called ERA. But in this era of ERA and the REF and things like judging and monitoring of research performance, it didn't feel right for me to be sitting in a research-focused school with a title like the Research School of Physics and Engineering, even though it wasn't the research school anymore. It didn't feel right to be sitting in that, doing research in a different discipline and not contributing to the kind of wider research endeavour of that school. So that was what kind of precipitated me to doing something else. And the decision to do a PhD in education was really, I suppose, because people can think that doing education research is somehow a bit easy, and there's almost an idea that, well, everyone can engage in the scholarship of teaching and learning, and they can publish a few papers on interventions they've tried in their classes. And I just felt like that was really arrogant. You know, as a physicist, it had taken me decades to get to the point where I felt like I'd developed real expertise. Certainly I couldn't imagine trying to do nuclear physics research without having done a PhD in nuclear physics. I mean, if somebody came along and said, oh, I've been doing a bit of physics in my spare time, so I'm now going to apply for a grant, we'd laugh at them. We wouldn't say, yes, welcome, come and use the accelerator at Argonne National Lab, or come and use the detector system that we've built in Italy. We'd just say, no, you're not actually an expert in this field. Go away, get yourself educated, and then you can come back and talk to us again. And I just thought, well, actually, I don't believe that social sciences in general, or education in particular, is any less worthy of trying to understand deeply, and that human interactions are really complicated. And so, you know, if you want to really understand them, you have to put in the same level of effort at studying and thinking and reflecting as you do to become a physicist.
So you started doing, if I understand correctly, when you were working at the Australian National University, you had started doing research, education research. So it's sort of, you were maybe, I don't want to say experimenting with it, but you were trying it. You were doing it even before you had a degree in education. And maybe that's partly what made you realize that you needed the degree. Do you think that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So I was nominated to do the ANU's graduate certificate in higher education. It's a bit like some of the HEA type fellowship programs that you get in UK universities now, only I have to say it was better than those. And I can say that with authority because I have taught those things, so I know what goes into them. I was nominated to do this novel version of it, where they wanted to get potential future leaders from across the university working in small groups on shared projects. So we did some conventional kind of coursework elements to it, and then we had to do a small group project as a piece of educational research. And I worked with two very close colleagues of mine, Kate Wilson, who is still a physicist working at ADFA, so UNSW has a campus at the Australian Defence Force Academy, and that's where Kate works, and Susan Howitt, who's a biologist, and who I've done a lot of subsequent research with. But we decided to do some research, and the ANU had still has a special elite degree called the Bachelor of Philosophy, and it's a research-rich degree. The students are doing nominally research projects from their first year all the way through, and it started in science and it hadn't been going that long. And so we thought we'd do some research into it because we thought it could be improved, was basically our reason for choosing it. So we did some research into that as part of this graduate certificate. And then Susan and I both went on and completed a master's in higher education, which involved expanding that research somewhat. And then we got some funding to take this research further. And at the same time, I was getting involved in other projects. I was also involved in another major project using augmented reality in pedagogical contexts in higher education. Yeah, I just thought, I mean, I kind of know what I'm doing, but I'd had no training in doing social science type research methods. I knew nothing about educational theory except for what we'd been taught in the graduate certificate and master's. And I knew that was fairly low level because it wasn't intended for people who were going to go on and be educational researchers. It was intended for people who were going to be teachers and needed some kind of baseline understanding of pedagogy, but that's not the same. And so I just felt like if I'm going to do this properly, it's all very well being able to get money to do it, but if I'm going to do it properly, then I need to learn how to do it.
People with a PhD sometimes say, I wish I could do a second PhD because it would be easier or it would go faster. Do you feel that it was an advantage having a degree already? Did you find that made it easier?
It was undoubtedly an advantage. I'm not sure it made it easier. They're different things. The undoubted advantage was that I know what research is. I know what's expected. And I guess knew already what it was like to be a PhD supervisor. I was fairly senior at ANU. I knew the realities of it, the politics that can go on and the expectations around. It was an advantage, but it didn't necessarily make it easier. I'm going to say something that probably most people will hate me for saying, but I mean, I did both my PhDs in less than 3 years. So I can't say, of course it was difficult doing my physics PhD, but I didn't feel like it was soul-destroying challenge that I did well to get through. I mean, it was just, we were all doing PhDs and we got through them and that was that. my supervisor left at the end of my second year. That actually probably was an advantage because it meant that I was in a position where I could pretty much decide at that point that I'd done enough and that I was going to write it up, bar a few things. They were both very difficult, very challenging, in the sense that you have to work really hard and you have to apply your brain and think really hard and grapple with difficult ideas that you wouldn't normally try and get your head around. When I did my physics PhD, I suppose I knew nothing. I never knew anybody that had done a PhD. I mean, obviously I knew my lecturers as an undergraduate, but none of them had ever talked about what it's like to do a PhD. And I didn't know anyone, no one in my family and no one that I knew, my friends that had done PhDs. And as I said, I really only applied for one because I didn't want to get a job. So I didn't actually have any real expectations. I just showed up and started doing stuff. So that was possibly an advantage in that I didn't have this kind of holy grail thing going on with a PhD. And then for the second time around, it was almost the opposite, but had the same effect in that because I knew what a PhD was, both times I just kind of got there and got in and started working. And so, yeah, different, but not easier.
After completing your PhD in physics, would you say that maybe you approached problems differently or you thought about things differently? And can you say that again after having a PhD in education? Has it changed the way you think about things?
Having 3 years of your life to try and understand something and to try and understand particular theoretical frameworks or methods or methodologies for trying to approach things, you know, having that concentrated time inevitably changes how you think in a way that trying to do these things kind of on the side while you're doing something else might not have the same fundamental effect on your perspective. But it's the immersive nature of a PhD that is, I mean, I was about to say that makes it a unique experience in someone's life, but of course for me it wasn't. I did it twice. But that's actually part of the reason why I wanted to do it again. I mean, I didn't, when I left ANU, I hadn't made the decision I was going to do a PhD in education. That was actually luck. I had a job at Oxford doing academic development and didn't really like it. Well, I enjoyed the academic development. I didn't enjoy that particular job. And as I was looking for other jobs, there was an advert for education, PhD scholarship. So I thought, well, why not? I can't think of anything more enjoyable that it'd be like. And again, this is where students who have come straight into their PhD from an undergraduate program will possibly hate me for saying this, but I thought it would be like having 3 years holiday going back and doing a PhD again. I won't have to go to any committee meetings. I won't have to do any marking. It was not a holiday is the wrong word, but it's immersive. It's a kind of hiatus from the rest of your life. And of course, I did a bit of part-time teaching. I did a bit of part-time research assistant stuff. So I was still going to meetings and I was still having to do marking and all of that. But they were partial and peripheral and things that I'd chosen to do for a bit of extra money, basically. Whereas in normal life, as an academic, you're lucky to find time. I mean, I don't want to say find time to do research, because I think there is always time to do research. It's just that it's in tiny bits. Being able to sit down for a week and think about something, never get that outside of the PhD experience.
Yeah. So you finished your PhD in education in 2016, and now you are a lecturer in education at the University of Stirling. So I'd like to ask you about one of your recent papers. This was published in the journal Science Education in 2018, and it's titled "Reflecting on the Use and Abuse of Scientific Data Facilitates Students' Ethical and Epistemological Development." What are epistemological beliefs that students have in science?
Oh, gosh. It's a very good question. I'm hesitating to answer it because the obvious answer is lots. Highly varied. But that's not a very helpful answer. There is a tendency for students coming into science in undergraduate programs and actually in graduate programs to overvalorize, to use a really social sciencey kind of term, but I actually mean it. So to place excess value on and to kind of overly, almost celebrate, I suppose, but to overly praise in a way the idea of science and what we were trying to do. And that was a paper. In a way, you picked an interesting one, because that was one, it's the lead author on it's my colleague Susan. We were in the course that paper describes, we were trying to challenge mainly first year undergraduate science students, but also students from non-science disciplines, to think about what science actually is and what the nature of scientific knowledge might be, to think about it a bit differently and to open themselves up to having a little bit more doubt.
In this paper, one of the things it mentions is that ethical and epistemological development is often not part of a science curriculum, but it is important to a science education. So what would you say in terms of why does it need to be included? What does it bring when it is included?
On a really narrow level, sort of science specific reasons why it's important. So for example, ethical development. As scientists, we have to make decisions about all sorts of things, and we often aren't necessarily thinking that they have any ethical impact. I mean, there are really obvious things where ethics do come in,
and where students and scientists know that particular types of behavior are bad, so manipulation of data, fraud, et cetera, et cetera. But actually that ethics comes into a huge number of other decisions which we might not really think it did come into. And part of what we were trying to do with that course and the associated research was to help students see that there's not a clear dividing line. There's often not a clear dividing line between where something is a question that involves ethical judgment and something else is not. The examples we were discussing with them were things like, okay, this is a clear case of fraud. Someone's made up their data. This is not such a clear case. Somebody has cleaned up their data. And you've cleaned your data up because you know that certain things were perhaps not ideal, that maybe there was something wrong with the experiment that day, the temperature had varied, or you'd forgotten to write something down, so you decide that you're going to remove that data point. But actually, if it hadn't been an outlier, you might not have removed it. There are actually, there's personal ethics in that, but there's also ethics in terms of the rights of other scientists to know what it is that you have excluded. And not that we talked about this with the students, but I do sometimes wonder whether we shouldn't publish what we exclude as well as what we don't include, not to say here's the stuff that we should have included, but to say this is the stuff that's been excluded, and it's been excluded on these grounds. And then people would still have access to the data, but would also have access to our rationale for why we didn't think it was correct. I mean, there's issues like that. There's also, in terms of the students' epistemological development, what we were talking about before about students often coming into university and higher degrees with a little bit too much emphasis on objective truth and scientific fact, that can make really getting to understand scientific uncertainty quite difficult, because it requires an epistemological shift in order to really get what, you know, uncertainty is good. It's valuable. It's part of nature. And if you are looking for the right answer all the time and believing there is a right answer or a single answer, then you're never really going to understand that. And that has implications for all sorts of things, not just to do with day-to-day scientific practice as a scientist, but also it's, in a way, it's our part of our professional responsibility as scientists to do our best to understand uncertainty and the implications of uncertainties in things like the COVID-19 statistics, climate change, etc. Because actually it is something that requires a lot of education to understand, and we're privileged in having that education, and therefore we should exercise it. I look at my friends and family who don't have any scientific education and how they're interacting with the COVID-19 statistics at the moment, and they and the modelling, the predictions being made in various models, and they've just got no understanding of, well, I know the same with the journalists. So I did see a graph not that long ago which said something about, you know, COVID-19 cases or death, it might have been deaths actually, peaked on this day, and then they peaked again 7 days later. Not because they peaked, but because there were statistical fluctuations in the reporting and the days of deaths, etc. And that is an epistemological shift, coming to understand, being able to look at a graph like that and understand that the uncertainty isn't just about measurement uncertainty, it's about inherent uncertainty and inherent scatter and inherent randomness. That's an important thing to be able to do.
If you look back over your career and the different things you've done, you could go back to any point in time and give yourself some advice on what to do next. What do you think you would do? Is there a point where you think some advice would have been helpful to you or not?
No. I have no idea what would have happened if I'd made any decisions differently from what I have. So there have been certain jobs that I've done that I really haven't enjoyed, but I wouldn't like to go back and advise myself not to take them.
Maybe explain that to me a little bit more. So even though you didn't enjoy them, in some sense, maybe there's a bit of appreciation that you learned something through that process, maybe, or it led you to something, to the next thing?
No, maybe, I don't know. But no, I think what I really meant by that was just at the very simple level of I don't know what the alternative would have been if I hadn't taken them. So I can't judge whether it would have been better or worse. I'm not racked with regret about where I am now. So it's not like I want to go back and advise myself, you know, don't do this because you'll end up in, you know, nearly 50 and back to being a lecturer again. There would be no point in advising me to take the decisions that I did take. And I think also a lot of the time I wasn't really taking decisions. I don't think I've ever had a very strategic approach to having a career. I haven't set myself goals and tried to get to them. I like learning to do new things and I like working with people. I have allowed myself to just do those things that let me do that. And the times when I haven't enjoyed my jobs have been when either the people that I have nominally been working with haven't been people who like working with people, and so we haven't been acting as a team. Lack of collegiality, I suppose. Lack of fun in that sense. That I mean, I like working with people because I like people, however odd they are. I prefer working with people on things than not. But the other thing is just is workload. And I mean, like right now, everybody in higher education is doing at least three people's jobs, and it is hard. I think right now my partner would say he'd like to go back in time and tell me not to take this job. But I wouldn't.
So he would say that because of the amount of the workload and the amount of demands that it places on you. Is that maybe why he would say that?
Yeah, that's part of it. My computer was patronizing me yesterday, as it increasingly does, and it sent me a little message saying, we've noticed that your computer is generally on between 6 a.m. and 7 p.m. Would you like us to make sure that no restarts are scheduled in this time? And I thought, well, first of all, there's no we. Please stop trying to be my mate. And second of all, if you were my mate, you'd be saying, we've noticed that you're working from 6 o'clock in the morning till 7 o'clock at night, 7 days a week. Stop it. Not can we make you do this more efficiently? So yeah, that's why my partner would probably advise me not to take the job.
And is that something that you think, so for example, last year at this time, was the workload more manageable?
No, we're in a very understaffed area, and it hasn't got any better because of coronavirus, but it was already pretty bad.
Yeah.
So yeah. First year sociology, which has 600 and something students in it, has two people teaching it.
Yeah.
People are trying to build in peer feedback and peer assessment, but the trouble is it actually takes quite a lot of dedicated teaching time to teach students how to give each other feedback.
Yeah.
And so in a way, it would be great if we could make that effort across the board at the start and have all students in all disciplines taught how to give each other feedback. Then for the rest of the year, we could say, okay, now go off and do it yourselves.
But I guess I'll come back to maybe a question here, which was, I was asking before about, you know, if you could go back at some point and give yourself advice.
I think because I'm not somebody who's ever really had particular goals in terms of the school, university, PhD, postdoc kind of transition, they all just happened. And I mean, there were moments where I didn't really know, I mean, there were lots of moments when I didn't know where things were going to go. I mean, as I said, I didn't know anybody who got a PhD. I didn't know anybody who was an academic. I didn't really know what it was. I didn't know what was supposed to happen. Maybe it probably says a lot about me that didn't leave me worrying, thinking I don't know what's supposed to happen. I just didn't know what was supposed to happen. So therefore didn't really have any expectations and therefore just went with whatever came along. When I finished my education PhD, that's probably one of the moments when I did think, oh God, I wish somebody had told me this before. And that was because as
I had no idea, and no one had ever said to me that to get a job in an education faculty or department in Scotland in particular, but also in many English universities, you have to be General Teaching Council registerable, preferably registered, and I am not, because to be General Teaching Council registered, you have to have actually done a school level teaching qualification, and I've never done that. And so suddenly I found myself in a position where I just spent just less than 3 years doing a PhD in education, thinking, well, maybe I'll, you know, get a job in a school of education or similar, and discovered that I did not meet the number one on the list of essential criteria for any job. I didn't mind in some ways, but it was one of those things where I did think, gosh, nobody thought to tell me that, you know, in the process of me applying to do this PhD and all the way through the time, the training that we get as PhD students, you know, there's now loads of training and loads of advice and loads of kind of, but nobody ever had that practical level of advice of, well, you do realize that there are almost no jobs for you. that would have been a bit of advice, but on the other hand, I'm glad nobody told me that advice, so I don't really want to go back and give myself that advice, because I might then have decided, oh well, I'm not going to do the PhD in education, and I'm really glad I did. I mean, I did a postdoc at Abate in their sociology division, but it was effectively human computer interaction work, and that was really interesting. And then this job came up here at Stirling, which was, the title is Lecturer in Lifelong Learning. And I don't teach on the undergraduate teaching programme because I'm not allowed. But I teach on professional level learning, a master's programme for practising teachers and the teaching qualification for further education. But Stirling is now one of only two universities in Scotland that run the further education qualification, and nowhere will employ me to teach on an ITE programme. So I'm very, very limited in where I could get a job or what kind of job I could get. On the other hand, I'm almost at the point of thinking I don't really want a lecturer-type job. I love teaching, absolutely love it. So it's not that. But I would almost rather have a series of short-term jobs. So it'd be nice to pick up a research contract for a bit and then maybe pick up a teaching contract for a bit. But I have no personal desire to carve out a career. I don't want to become a professor in an education department or anything like that. I've been there since I've done it and don't need to do it again. There's almost a pressure on you if you are a lecturer, an early career academic, to be ambitious and try and climb the ladder, and I'm almost at the point of thinking I should let somebody else have this job that does want to get promoted and does want to climb the ladder.
And then if you were to do that, where do you think you would go next? What do you think that would be?
Well, you know, there's plenty of short term, sort of 2 year, 3 year research projects and looking for research assistants, and I've got lots of experience. You know, people would be getting a lot if I was just being employed as a research assistant. I mean, and another, there are people I've worked with before who would definitely be happy to give me a short-term contract again. And yeah, I don't need to be planning for 40 years of what am I going to do with my life. I just need to keep interested and busy. Before coronavirus hit, I had been planning on, over the summer, walking up the west coast of Scotland. That got put on hold. So having something a bit more flexible where I could work for a bit and then take a few months off to do something like that and then pick up another job.
So it sounds like variety is very important to you.
Yeah, over long term, yes, it is. I mean, it's not like I need to be doing something different every day, but As I said, I mean, now at the start of this, the reason for leaving ANU, where I was in many ways very happy, and was because I just couldn't imagine doing the same thing for another 25 years. And I guess I'm very lucky. I am confident that I will always be able to get a bit of work here and there, and I don't feel the need to. This is my third permanent position, and I don't feel the need to have a permanent position.
It's very interesting. I think it gives students a lot of perspective, because I think that they often are very worried that their next step is somehow going to be fatal.
Yes. Okay. But it's not. It's not going to be fatal. Not unless it's over a cliff, you know.
Right. So I'll just say thank you again. Thanks very much for speaking with me today.
It's a pleasure,
thank
Linda. You for your time.
physics courses in schools and universities tend to have many more boys and men than girls and women. Did you ever find that awkward or challenging? Why did you decide to leave? Why did you decide to leave?